I want to begin tonight by outlining kind of the pre-Great Awakening landscape of America. Kind of, probably about a couple months ago, on some of the foundings of the colonies itself. We looked at the establishment of Jamestown and the Anglican Church there in Virginia. We looked at the Plymouth Colony and those coming out of the Dutch trying to find a new England, kind of creating a new place. Those were the Pilgrims and the Pilgrim Brethren. And so we looked at kind of these colonies, but a lot has happened since then. More people have begun to flock over to the colonies, and with that, they are kind of creating their own religious climates throughout each one of the colonies. And you could really divide the colonies up into three sections. You have the northern colonies, the middle colonies, and the southern colonies. In the 17th and the beginning of the 18th century, the clergymen of the northern colonies, primarily represented by Massachusetts and Connecticut, were focused primarily on solidifying the place of the church within society. These were predominantly Congregationalist churches, which maintained the Puritan and the separatist routes which they originally came from. Concerned about what they saw as a growing indifference to religion and society. This time, especially within Upper New England, you had a big thing. A lot of these whalers were coming there. This was a time when we got our oil to light lamps from whales and things like that. This is the time when Moby Dick was written, very much in this kind of time frame. There were a lot of tradesmen and sailors. And if you know anything about sailors, they usually don't come with the greatest manners. And so there was really kind of a growing coldness that was developing there within society, especially among the youth. And with this indifference, especially there in the coastal towns, which the coastal towns are always the first to turn away. It's no different today as well. Coastal towns usually seem to be the most progressive and liberal in society. So they decided that they needed, in order to try and win these youth back, to try and make society more Christian again or more moral, their idea was we need to make church structures more formal. That's what we need to do. We need to go back to more formality within religion and more structure. We need to be better established. And so many of them, kind of going against their Puritan and their separatist ways, began to look back at the Church of England and said, well, maybe we can adopt some of those liturgical structures that we ran away from in order to get some structure back. Because maybe that's the reason why people are slipping away, is because we have lost our structure. Now, the middle colonies were completely the opposite. The middle colonies boasted a plethora of religious diversity. The Baptists in Rhode Island, the Quakers in Pennsylvania, the Lutherans and the Methodists in places like Pennsylvania as well. Presbyterians began to get a stronghold not only in Pennsylvania but also in Maryland. And predominantly in Maryland was the Catholics. And so in these middle colonies you had Baptists, Quakers, Lutherans, Methodists, Presbyterians, and Catholics. And what made these colonies so fascinating was, unlike anything that had happened before, most of these various religious groups lived and worked together in relative harmony. There was very little infighting. There was very little warring between them over religious matters. Now, though they lived in harmony, something began to develop with these diverse colonies. And that was a growing denominational sectarianism and a consciousness which became much more widespread. Before, you kind of were this kind of belonged to group. And but for the first time ever, people are beginning to really proudly wear the name, I'm a Baptist, I'm a Methodist, I'm a Quaker. That really became your identifying factor much quicker than you would see just the idea, oh, I'm a Christian, or I'm a believer, or I'm a Reformed, or I'm a Lutheran. It was much more sectarian. So you started seeing things like the First Baptist Church, the First Presbyterian Church. This kind of denominationalism really begins to grow within this diverse middle colonies. And this was most seen amongst the Baptists and Presbyterians, who are always trying to compete with each other in everything. That's just the way that we are. At this time, This is especially seen in Philadelphia. In Philadelphia, in 1707, was the first Philadelphia Baptist Association. So the first American Baptist Association was the Philadelphia Baptist Association, formed in 1707 between a cooperation with English Baptist and Welsh Baptist. They adopted what is named as the Philadelphia Confession of Faith, and that really is the was pretty much the American version of the London Baptist Confession. It was almost verbatim the London Baptist Confession of 1689, and adopted pretty much very little language. It was highly particular, highly Calvinistic in its leaning, but that was the early Baptist Confession of Faith and Association. The very same year in Philadelphia, Presbyterians always competing, Francis McAmee organized a Presbyterian synod that gathered a large array of Presbyterian immigrants from Scotland, from Northern Ireland, England, and all of the New England colonies. And so the vast majority of Presbyterians were coming from these many immigrant countries and were gathering together in this Presbyterian synod. The religious pluralism of the middle colonies would lay it pretty much the template for what America would become. A place of religious diversity, of religious harmony, and the freedom to practice one's religious convictions. And so when we start talking about the First Amendment and things like that, it really looked to these middle colonies as an example for how this kind of religious diversity and freedom could be done, could be lived out, which had not been seen anywhere else before. In the Anglican South, it was an entirely different story from both the North and the Middle Colonies. In many ways, the major Christian development around the start of the 18th century was a tragedy for the Anglican South. This was a time when the slave system was finalized and the churches were enlisted as agents enforcing that system. At about the same time, the Church of England brought a measure of order into the formal life of the southern colonies. Everywhere, pretty much from Virginia to South Carolina to Georgia, these colonies were overwhelmingly Anglican. They would not allow for dissenters to live in these colonies. And so there was religious persecution still happening in Virginia, in Georgia, and in South Carolina. And that's really important because who will write the Bill of Rights? It's James Madison. He's going to write the Bill of Rights. And it's going to be Baptist ministers, namely John Leland from Virginia, who spent years under persecution, who is going to actually give him the draft and speak with him to write the Religious Amendment Clause. The Baptists of Virginia are basically said, we will not vote for anything. Virginia will not accept or ratify the Constitution if there is no Bill of Rights. That's what it was so important to them, because they had spent years under religious persecution. And this was the great issue, the great tragedy of the Anglican South. But even worse than that was that this same establishment also made clear that its efforts to convert slaves and incorporate them into the churches would be undertaken without questioning the slave system. That was something that could not be spoken against, and primarily because the vast majority of kind of the Anglican culture, especially in the South, almost created a caste system per se, with the noble plantation owners kind of running everything. And so you didn't speak out against the slave system, because if you did, you'd be speaking against their income. So you don't do it, and in many ways, churches became basically totally in line and complicit with this horrible system of slavery there in the South. The almost inevitable result was that the religion of Anglicanism became a prop for unusual social deference and the legitimization of the slave system. So by the 1730s, it was possible to discern three distinct religious patterns in the 13 colonies. In New England, with its heritage of Puritanism as vital people's religion, was the scene of some uneasiness about the decline of the church's influence. In the middle colonies, there was a Protestant pluralism, though it was neither celebrated nor really even noticed by the other sections of the colonies. In the South, the Anglican Church had become a part of a deferential culture in which slavery was a key feature both economically and ideologically. And under these conditions, the mid-century religious awakenings proved explosive, both in simple terms and with respect to the church's relationship to social order. New England ministers may have sought up revival to shore up their status. The middle colony preachers probably wanted revival so that they could expand their own denominational outreach. And southern Anglicans probably hoped that it would establish a deeper piety and that ultimately more could be assimilated within the Anglican establishment. However, revival would come. And when it arrived, the colonial Great Awakening was a surprise. Its currents of renewal outran the expectations of the clergy. And from Nova Scotia all the way down to Georgia, it changed the rules of the game for the American church. And that's where we turn now, the Great Awakening. The colonial revival was called a Great Awakening because it touched so many regions and so many aspects of the colonial life. Although the Great Awakening represented more of a general upsurge of revivalistic piety more than it was just a distinct event, it was vastly important for both the churches and the American society. This was no one-time, just really big awakening. This was an entire movement of revival from Nova Scotia to Georgia. The entire colonies were on fire with this new revivalism. God had awakened a sleeping giant with these 13 colonies. In New England, the revival brought new life to many congregational churches and greatly stimulated the growth of the Baptist. In the middle colonies, the Presbyterians and the Dutch Reformed, after initial divisions over the practice of revival, ended by growing rapidly because of its emphasis. In the southern colonies, which were affected in the last phases of the awakening, the revival led to a new growth for Baptists in the South and began to prepare the way for the great Methodist movement of the post-revolutionary period. After the post-revolutionary period, and the Anglican Church, not shockingly, loses a lot of its gusto because we're no longer attached to England, Methodism really took over in the South, primarily because many of these Methodist ministers had been prior Anglican ministers. The awakening was made up of local revivals happening nationwide. And though many were a part of it, there were many traveling preachers who rode around, what they were called circuit riders, who would ride these circuits and preach to the nation. There were two primary figures, two national leaders who led the Great Awakening. An English preacher, George Whitefield, and a New England theologian, Jonathan Edwards. And we look to Whitefield first. We already touched on Whitefield briefly last time when we looked at the rise of Methodism. Whitefield, this powerful preacher there, helping lead along with John Wesley, the revivals that have taken place in England. And it was he who would be vital in establishing and preaching and launching the awakening there in America. The Anglican preacher visited Georgia briefly in 1738 to aid in the founding of an orphanage. And when he returned to the colonies in 1739, his reputation as a dramatic preacher preceded him. His visit became a sensation. And when he preached in New England during the fall of 1740, Whitefield addressed crowds of up to 8,000 people nearly every day for over a month. Now that's a crowd. I can't imagine. And remember, there's no microphones. This is straight oration there. That's just out there. That's rhetorical masterpiece. This tour, one of the most remarkable episodes in the whole history of American Christianity, was the key event in New England's Great Awakening. Whitefield returned often to the American colonies, where in 1770 he died, as he had hoped he might, in the midst of yet another preaching tour. Whitefield's greater cultural significance was his innovative approach to preaching. He was not a good organizer. That's what the Wesleys were for. The Wesleys were the administrators, and Whitefield was the preacher. So those quickened by his preaching had to find their own ways to find a church, whereas the Wesleys created Methodism. You get a method and you get them into a church. You save them, you baptize them, and you disciple them. You get them into a church. Whitfield was just like, you got to get saved. He would convert them. And it became really what we saw in many ways, the Crusades of Billy Graham. You came, you preach. People might get saved, you will not, but they were kind of left to themselves. They didn't really get pushed into churches. Luckily, these people were at that time in a culture that was, churches were everywhere, and it was the central part of any society. And so that wasn't hard too much to find churches. The biggest issue for them was trying to figure out what denomination they would become after their conversion. Whitfield knew how to address plain people in plain language. That was really the key. At a time when many of the Puritan preachers preached very lengthy and depth and high scholastic words that would often go over the labor. And if you've read the Puritans, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You would read them and you got to read them like 16 times just to even get what the heck they're talking about sometimes. And still, you don't know what they're talking about. And that's the best way. Or I love, Edwards. Edwards, who we're going to look at here in a bit, he can write, start on a sentence and literally take you in a long journey around before finally getting to his point like 45 pages later in the book. And you're like, all right, there we go. That's what I was looking for. But that was how they wrote. And what made Whitfield so amazing, it's what his predecessors, men like Charles Spurgeon, will pick up, is the ability to take profound and deep biblical truths and to simply funnel them in plain, everyday language so that even the person who has the lowest education can still grasp the truths and the sweet truths of the gospel. However, not only that, not only did he have this ability to bring this kind of sweet and simple message that was powerful, he combined a skill that he had taken from long before, and that was his dramatic stage presence. Prior to becoming a preacher, Whitfield studied to be an actor. After he was saved, he left the stage behind, he left acting behind, but nevertheless, he remained an actor. In every way, shape, and fashion, he had an unusual sensitivity for what it took to secure an audience. He appealed to the heart. He knew how to play on emotions, weeping in sermons and doing all of these things that really pulled on people's heartstrings. And he was casual in the extreme about denominational differences. Another thing about Whitfield that was so important to the Great Awakening preachers is they did not worry about denominational lines. They preached to everyone the same. A little bit later on, that would even include Native Americans and African Americans. He would preach to them all the same. It didn't matter what you were, Baptist, Methodist, Catholic, or whatever, you were going to get preached to the need to be born again. And that was what really began to create a unity among Americans at a time when there was sectarianism growing more and more. Besides these innovations, Whitfield also preached his sermons ex tempore, speaking directly without notes on the strength of his own charisma and the force of his message. And so there was no notes. Oftentimes he would just open his Bible and begin preaching a text. But most of his sermons were primarily on John 3, the need for the new birth, born again, things like that. John 6 he preached a lot of. He pretty much just preached John all the time, which is not a bad place to go if you're going to preach evangelistic sermons. But that's what he did. Preach John often, preach the need for the new birth, preached on all who would come and repent and believe that they would be saved. And his charisma, his stage presence, all was extremely important in awakening so many people to this kind of preaching that they had never heard before. For all of his innovations and for all of the excitement he created with his dramatic media events, Whitfield remained most fundamentally an agent of his message. His message was simply this. If you could boil down every single Whitfield sermon, it would come down to this. God's grace for guilty sinners. God is holding his hand out. God is here. God is offering His grace today. Do not harden your heart. Do not turn. You must be born again. Believe, repent and believe and turn, and you will be saved and you will have an assurance of that salvation. This was a simple but profound message that most of these people had never heard before. All they had heard was lengthy, I'm talking 2 and 3 hour sermons that were simply written and read just like this. There was no oration of it. It was just reading the manuscript. And so this was shocking, and it pulled so many people in. Having attended one of his sermons in 1740 at Middletown, Connecticut, an ordinary farmer from nearby Kensington left a record of the message and the power with which Whitfield could drive it home. This man's name was Nathan Cole, and this is what he wrote in his journal. Quote, "When I saw Mr. Whitfield come upon the scaffold that had been erected for the sermon, he looked almost angelical. A young, slim, slender youth before some thousands of people with a bold, undaunted countenance. And my hearing how God was with him everywhere as he came along, it solemnized my mind and put me into a trembling fear before he began to preach. For he looked as if he was clothed with authority from the great God, and a sweet, solemn solemnity set upon his brow. And my hearing him preach gave me a heart wound. By God's blessing, my old foundation was broken up, and I saw that my own righteousness would not save me." End quote. Well, you wish a lot of people would leave your sermons feeling that way. That's amazing. And this is just one of countless testimonies of this kind of response to Whitfield's preaching. What Cole found in rushing off to hear Whitfield was what countless others in his generation and succeeding generations discovered. It was the reality of such religious experience that Whitfield's preaching sought. It was the power of the reality that many naysayers in Whitfield's age, men from the Enlightenment, as well as self-confident economic, social, and psychological explanations that were offered, had never been able to fathom the way in which Whitfield was able to reach so many people. And perhaps the biggest fan of Whitfield was Benjamin Franklin. Franklin often said he didn't believe a word that Whitfield said, but he said if he ever were to believe a preacher, it would be Whitfield. He was amazed at the man's ability and often would use Whitfield's sermons and messages as a means to do experiments, oftentimes to test acoustics and acoustic ranges. He would measure the distance from Whitfield's sermon pulpit out to the farthest end of the crowd, and he would do a calculation based upon how many people were fitting in the area and Whitfield could reach with the preaching of his voice on simply his words alone, his own speaking voice alone. And Franklin estimated that in one sermon in Philadelphia, Whitfield preached to a crowd of 24,000 people, and he could hear him at the very out of the crowd itself. So that just goes to tell you the power of the oration that he had. I can't imagine doing that day after day. I would be so hoarse. I can't imagine it. But he did it. The realities of heartfelt conversion Whitfield facilitated even more than the extensive changes he brought to the practice of religion are why he is such an important figure in his age and why his legacy has remained at the heart of the history of Christianity in America. But where there was a great preacher, I believe there was even an even greater apologist and theologian. And that is who we turn to now. A man who was born in the Americas, a New Englander, coming from a line of religious thinkers and revivalists like Solomon Stoddard. This man was Jonathan Edwards, the greatest American theologian. That's just my belief. Some people would say he was one of the greatest. I would say he is the greatest American theologian. If Whitfield was the most important preacher, Jonathan Edwards was by far the greatest theologian and apologist of revivalism in the Great Awakening. Questions of revival became the occasion for a string of works that made Edwards America's greatest theologian and a figure whose work is still the subject of serious academic study and the source of popular theological stimulation. And when I mean stimulation, I mean like mind-numbing. You probably should take a nap after reading a few pages. I don't think I have ever had to read something more slowly than Jonathan Edwards' work. Maybe Owens's work on the book of Hebrews, but next to that, Edwards is probably the hardest reader I've ever had because he's just so powerful. He's so depth. He fits so much into sentences. Questions, you know, one of the biggest things that Edwards was trying to defend during this time was there was a growing attack on revival. And there was an attack on two fronts. One attack was to say, you shouldn't be preaching this way to men. You shouldn't be preaching emotionally. You shouldn't be allowing. There are no place for affections in the church. It's supposed to be mentally stimulating. That's it. We preach to the minds of men and we let God do everything else. We don't need to do anything that might stir them to action. That was one side. The other side was an attack on revival by perverting revival. And that was to turn it into man-centered manipulation, doing weird, ecstatic things that could not be found in Scripture, but that were sense of just emotionalism that could not be tied to an actual work of the Holy Spirit. So that was the two fronts. You had an attack of the perversion of it by doing things and manipulating revival in wrong ways, and you had people basically saying, we don't want any of that emotion here. We don't want any affection. And Edwards found what I believe is the perfect balance. He found the balance within that of what true revival looks like. And his first work that really took this on and was central to bringing both Wesley and Whitfield over to America was his work, A Faithful Narrative of the Surprising Work of God in the Conversion of Many Hundreds of Souls in Northampton. That was written in 1737, and it's Edwards' first widely distributed work. It described a time of renewal that had descended upon Northampton, there in Connecticut where he lived, after Edwards preached a very lengthy sermon series on justification by faith. And you can actually read those compilations of sermons in his work titled Justification by Faith, which you should. It's really, really good. This book, this surprising work, this book not only set out a model for reporting extraordinary spiritual works, but it also established evangelical connections with John Wesley in England and James Robe in Scotland, because at this time in history, God was doing a work. He was doing it in England. He was doing a work in the Welsh revivals in Scotland and in America. God was setting the church on fire during this period. His most famous sermon, a revival sermon preached in 1741, is titled Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. This is a masterpiece of preaching. Edwards preached it on an evening in 1741. It was raining outside, and he preached with a candle right here on his pulpit. That's the only light that he had. It was almost ghostly in many ways. And there he read, and he was not a very thundering figure. He was actually very short, and he was kind of monotone and kind of feeble in the way that he spoke. Whereas Whitfield's this great orator, Edwards is just kind of like this little small feeble man up there with this candle lighting his face. And he preaches this sermon. Oh, sinner, you have one foot in hell already and the other is ready to slip. And people there weeping and crying while he is just preaching away in this very small little frail monotone voice because of the power of the message. It is a literary just masterpiece. And so much so that this work, maybe not more, but for years was studied in English departments across the world because of just the brilliant way in which Edwards wrote. His views, his illustrations, his analogies, his metaphors, just masterful. Yet, on balance, he spent much less time and energy depicting the wrath of God than he did preparing sermons about the beauties of Christ. He wrote often about the perfections of Christ and writing formal theological treatises on these things. In a major work examining revival phenomena published in 1746, he wrote what is known as a treatise concerning religious affections. It's actually on our recommended reading list this year, pastor recommended reading list, so you should go read that. In this work, he argued that true Christianity is not revealed by the quantity or intensity of religious emotions, but is rather present where a heart has been changed to love God and to seek His pleasure. That's where real religious affection is. A heart that is overwhelmed by a love for God and a desire to seek all of one's pleasure in Him. Probably the most notable pastor theologian today that is inspired by Edwards is John Piper. And you can see so much of Edwards and Piper, primarily in Piper's view of what is known as Christian hedonism. That is to say that God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in Him. That's Christian hedonism. That's John Piper, and that's the Edwards flowing through Piper. After he died, Edwards Franz published a work of his entitled The Nature of True Virtue in 1765, in which he suggests that an experience of God's grace is the only basis for ultimate and enduring morality. Human experience can account for basic human goodness, but never for what Edwards calls true virtue. True virtue is eternal, Edwards says, and can only come from God. One of Edwards' earlier books was Freedom of the Will, 1754. And he presents the traditional Calvinistic understanding of the nature of man and salvation, but he does so with a powerful new shape that had never been explained this way. Its basic argument is that the will does not constitute a real entity, but rather is an expression of the strongest motive in a person's character. In other words, a sinful human nature cannot desire to please God unless God, by a miraculous infusion of grace, changes the sinner's character. The will is not something that is within man that is just like its own little thing, its own little bubble. But it is the very outworking of the desires of men. And the reason why the will is in bondage, the reason why the will is broken and unable to choose God, is because the will is subject to a fallen human nature, which always goes after what it wants. It always goes after the flesh. Just like Paul said in Romans 3, no one seeks after God. No one does what is good. It constantly goes after that which is wicked. And so that's what he's saying here. He's not saying there was no such thing as free will as once, or there isn't a will. He simply says that the will is bound to the nature. And unless the nature is changed, the will can never go to God. And so when God comes and places His sovereign grace on man, what He does is He doesn't force man against his will. He simply changes his nature and opens man's eyes. And for the first time ever, man sees Jesus in all of His glory and beauty and wonder, which he could never see before, and he runs to Christ. That's what it is when God opens the heart by effectual grace. He doesn't drag. No one's getting drugged down the aisle going, I really don't want to go to heaven. No, for the first time ever, Edwards says, God has opened their eyes by grace. And for the first time, they've seen Christ in all of His glory. And they run to Him freely and volitionally. That's the beautiful argument of Freedom of the Will. And I highly recommend that book as well. Just read anything Edwards writes. Edwards supported that thrust with another work entitled Original Sin, and basically arguing that all humanity was present in Adam and are thus not only sinners in Adam, but guilty in Adam as well. We all have both original sin and original guilt. We are born under the condemnation of God's wrath and needing to be saved from it. Jonathan Edwards was a theologian overwhelmed by the majesty and the splendor of God. It's why he's one of my favorite theologians, because there's such a view and a desire to explain and behold the magnitude and beauty and supremacy of God in his writings. And it just has the sweet aroma. Every one of his works just has this sweet aroma of the supremacy and beauty of Christ within it. And it's just, he's second to none when you're talking about the excellencies of God. That really is where Edwards just stands head above everyone else. The major themes of his theology are the greatness and glory of God, the utter dependence of humanity on God for salvation, and the ethereal beauty of the life of holiness. Edwards was not only a fervent Christian, he was a theological genius. He spent part of his time studying the best philosophy and science of the day, especially from his contemporaries, Isaac Newton, John Locke. And he did so in order to explore the workings of the world that Edwards believed God had made for his own glory. The ends for which he has made all things is the glory of God. That was Edwards' thing. And so he wanted to study science. And part of his scientific study was he believed in the new sciences of medicine. He believed that they were God's grace to man to help us preserve life and to have a common grace to help humanity. And so one of the first men to be willing to put himself forward as a volunteer for the smallpox vaccine was Edwards. Unfortunately, it didn't go well for Edwards. Edwards would take some of the vaccine, and ultimately, he would die. Because remember, at this time, there was no proper dose. They would basically put a cut on your arm, and they would take some of the pus from someone with smallpox, and they would enter it into the wound, and hopefully not give you too much, while also giving you just enough to give you some immunity. So it was a really weird science at this time, and a lot of people lost their life, but he believed in it. He believed in that. He was also the president of Princeton College at the time. And all of the Ivy Leagues were being developed during this period, and every one of them were built on Christian foundations. So that's another thing that's pretty key here that's definitely changed since then. In later generations, American revivalists were more likely to follow Edwards in appealing for the new birth than were American theologians in defending the broadly Calvinistic themes so central to his concern. So what's amazing is as Calvinism will wane with the rise of modernity, kind of the growing view of man that happens in modernity, what doesn't happen is this growing emphasis on the new birth pretty much stays plain in the evangelistic preaching of America. So with those understanding of those two guys, I want to now look at some of the effects of the revivals. What was the wake of the revivals of the Great Awakening? The Great Awakening addressed the religious lapse of American colonies by realizing one important factor. A commonwealth is made up of individuals. And the only way to create a truly Christian commonwealth that would usher in this hoped for eschatological golden age, we'll talk about that in a second, was to stop trying to reform society as a whole and to start reforming the individual by stressing the need for personal conversion. So instead of just trying to fix society in one broad swoop, what you need to do is just preach the gospel one person at a time. And as you change individuals, you change families, and families change societies. That was the idea. And I think we'd be wise to get back to that mentality. Now, this idea of ushering in a hoped-for eschatological age, men primarily like Jonathan Edwards and the Puritan thinkers at this time really developed an eschatology known as postmillennialism. And the idea is that the church would ultimately be triumphant in the world. And when I mean triumphant, I don't mean there will be a church in every tribe, tongue, and nation, which is what I think is the biblical view of triumphism. But no, it will literally take over every single human society. That in this age, there will be almost predominantly, almost overwhelmingly, a Christian world. That almost all governments and societies will be Christianized. and that this would usher in a golden millennium for 1,000 years while Christ would come and reign in his Christianized world that has been dominated by the church. Now, post-millennialism today, most of them reject this idea of a 1,000-year golden reign that the church will establish, but there still is a view that basically says the church will be triumphant over all human establishments in some form or fashion. But this idea of ushering in a golden age where Christ would come and reign on earth with his victorious church was very much the mindset of the Puritans. It's why the Pilgrims came to America, was that they were hoping to establish that nation, that holy nation that Christ would come and be able to dwell in. Now, this idea for the personal conversion was so important, because the question was no longer, what group do you belong to? Are you a Baptist? Are you a Methodist? Are you a Quaker? No, instead, the question became, have you been born again? Have you been born again? That was the central change in the religious mindset of the individual during this time. This concept promoted a profound sense of equality for all men and women who stood guilty before a holy God and were in need of personal regeneration. This was something that was so important in a time where the idea of the covenant just kind of extended to all family members. It now took everybody and said, it doesn't matter if your mom or dad were Christian. You are under the just condemnation of God and you need a personal conversion. You need to be born again. You can't ride the spiritual coattails of your mom and dad. And that was key to this period. This message was carried throughout all the colonies, throughout all the denominations, and even to African and Native Americans through the preaching and teaching of men like Samuel Davies there on the left and David Brainerd. Now, David Brainerd was actually a good-looking guy. I'm not going to say, man, he could have been a movie star. But I got this picture of him primarily because it shows a picture of him leaving some of the Native Americans that he was speaking to. He died at a very young age and was actually going to be Jonathan Edwards' son-in-law. Jonathan Edwards wrote a book, another bang bang, you should read this book, called The Diary of David Brainerd. And it basically goes through and talks about the work that David Brainerd did among the Native Americans, the evangelistic work that he did, the missionary work. It's just a really good work. Probably the easiest read you'll ever read from Edwards too. And so that's to keep in mind as well. The Great Awakening had taken the gospel to African Americans as well, and it established a theology that placed them on equal ground with all others in the eyes of God. This was so important. All men stood on level ground before the cross of Jesus. And that was so important. Whitfield and the other itinerant preachers had reminded these African Americans, these slaves at times, that God was no respecter of persons. Many black converts began to take up the task of preaching themselves and believed that their past slavery was simply preparing them for entry into the people of God, just as it had the Israelites in Egypt. One of these great African American preachers was Jupiter Hammond. Hammond was an educated slave who had absorbed all of the politicized Christian language of the revolutionary period, and used this as an opportunity to evangelize his fellow blacks and to inform them as to what he believed was the work of God in the formation of this, quote, new and glorious nation. He believed in what America was going to become. He thought, when America is free, then we'll be free, because it's going to be built on this theology that says God's no respecter of persons. Hammond was a remarkable preacher, and his evangelistic writings were filled with both the covenantal rhetoric of the colonial Puritans, the evangelical underpinnings of the Great Awakening, and the highly patriotic and nationalistic zeal of the sermons surrounding the Revolution. These concepts can be seen in two of his most important evangelistic letters, A Winner's Peace and An Evening Improvement. Those are two really good works done by Jupiter Hammond. In these and other of his evangelistic writings, Hammond called upon his fellow African Americans to rise up from their wretched state, and that through their moral and spiritual reform, blacks would become an autonomous and integral part of the new American society. Hammond believed that with the new and free nation, all that once divided the people of the colonies, race, economics, religion, and etc. would all melt away into a shared national identity as Americans. And this, to me, is the most heartbreaking part of this lecture, because that wasn't what it was going to be. Unfortunately, it would be almost two centuries after the Revolutionary War before African Americans would be able to realize the dream that Jupiter Hammond had preached so proudly about, because he believed that if you believe, like you're saying, that God is no respecter of persons, that we all stand equal at the foot of the cross, how can that not be the same in society? And unfortunately, the sad reality was that there were so many Christians during this period that did not have a consistent worldview. And that's what it boiled down to. They did not have a consistent worldview. The revivals of the Great Awakening had broken down the local and particular allegiances of Americans. This new emphasis on the individual caused individuals to see that a unity and brotherhood could be found by worrying less about secondary and tertiary matters of the faith and focused only on a shared conversion experience. Thus, it was through the Great Awakening that preachers were able to show that the greatest common good is always found through reforming and equipping the individual rather than addressing society as a whole. Not only that, but the revivalist preachers like George Whitefield were able to connect the people in the colonies with a new form of media, using printed tracts and by publishing his sermons in the newspaper. No one had ever done that before. No one had ever published their sermons in newspapers. And Whitefield said, I can't be everywhere at once, so I'll just publish my sermons and send them out mass wide. And this was a great way, is if he was going to go into a city in a few weeks, is he would have his sermons published in those cities, and that way he would gain an even bigger crowd when he came. By publishing the sermons, they could gain a much larger audience and unite the colonies under similar ideas in the way that they had not done before. It's kind of the way we use our social media platforms today. This practice set a stage that many American ideological leaders would follow. Many American leaders would say, man, this idea of publishing your thinking and your sermons, that could be very handy in spreading our ideas. Men like Thomas Paine, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, and many more would utilize the idea of taking their messages and having them published to get their ideas out. It's where we get things like Thomas Paine's Common Sense. It's where we get things like the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers. These were all them writing against each other. The colonial people had been awakened, their hearts fixed upon Christ, and with the newfound emphasis upon the individual, it seemed as if all was well. However, underneath the surface of this growing unity of the colony was an unresting sentiment that was growing ever so quickly. The colonists could no longer be second-class citizens in an empire that only seemed to take and never give. A taxation without representation. The colonies had very much maintained the belief that God and Providence had established them as a new covenant people to usher in the golden age of liberty and freedom. And they were very close to having their promised land, they believe. But first, they needed to escape the tyranny of the modern pharaoh, the British King George III. And that brings us to the American Revolution. New England clergy, long before 1763, were utilizing biblical arguments for ideas like natural rights, this idea of inalienable rights. That came from preachers. It didn't come from thinkers, it came from preachers. The idea of the social contract and the right and the obligation to resist tyrants. Those all came from preachers, not politicians. As early as 1687, pastors like Reverend Wise in Massachusetts was already teaching that, quote, taxation without representation is tyranny. The consent of the governed is the foundation of government. And, quote, that every man must be acknowledged equal to every man. If only they would have saw that through. Now, clergy had the tyrant to aim their charges against. the American clergy took on a new identity, an identity of being patriotic prophets who had to protect the stipulations of the covenant. And they knew the only way to do that was to throw off the yoke of that which was keeping it from reaching the destiny assigned to it by the Almighty. I'm reminded of one preacher who, in preaching a sermon on Exodus, and if you read all of these early patriotic sermons around the Revolution, dude, they were so political. This idea of separation from church and state, they were so political. This one sermon on Exodus, one preacher said, "Today we once again face a Pharaoh in King George III. And if he will not heed the rod of Moses and let his people go, then we will take to him the sword of Joshua." That was the kind of preaching that was happening around this time. If such led to war, the colonial clergy were certain that God would be on their side. Dr. Stephen Langdon got to the heart of this when he preached an election sermon. Oh yeah, by the way, when they did votings and elections, they did big sermons about it. So if you went to like an election party when someone was nominated, there was usually a sermon done on that day. He wouldn't have like a keynote speaker. He would have someone come and preach a sermon for him. This goes to show you, once again, things have changed quite a bit. But at this election sermon in 1775, Dr. Stephen Langdon closed the sermon with this, quote, "May the God for Jacob defend his own, send us help from his sanctuary, and strengthen us out of Zion." The American colonists once again saw themselves bearing the battle against what they believed was the Antichrist, as had their Puritan fathers. And it was not long before American clergy were calling their men to arms. Many of these preachers themselves led the men from their communities in the battle, and perhaps the most prominent being Peter Muhlenberg. This man right here, I love this picture of him standing up over it, revealing his black, taking his black robe off and revealing a revolutionary officer uniform underneath. He told them, I love it, he was preaching from Ecclesiastes 3, a time for this and a time for that. And he ends his sermon with this call. There is a time for all things, a time to preach and a time to pray. But there is also a time to fight, and that time has now come. And he stands up and pulls his black robe open, and he has this revolutionary outfit on, ready to go to the war and be one of the prominent officers in the battle there in the Revolutionary War. He would lead these men out of his church and set up a group of militia and minutemen ready to fight under the direction of General George Washington. Just a real fascinating time. And this group, these ministers with their black robes, formed a regiment known as the Black Robe Regiment. And the idea was the vast majority of the insurgents to raise up and to establish this thunderous cry to get American men to fight for the cause of revolution was led by the preachers. It was the preachers who did that. And so it was such a different time. All over the nation, preachers of the revolution, building on the foundations laid by the Puritans and evangelical preachers, were calling Americans to be united for the cause of God and His divinely given rights. One historian writes, quote, "It was humble pastors whose flocks were drawn the numberless little companies of minutemen who formed the first army against which the tides of British valor rolled in vain on the heights of Bunker Hill," end quote. The war to establish a new independent nation had begun, and preachers and chaplains fueled the fire which burned in the hearts of the Minutemen throughout the colonies. The ending of the war in 1783 had important results for religion. The influence of the church contributed to the development of a ban on any established church and of the right to a free exercise of religion as set forth in the First Amendment to the Constitution. It also brought about the separation of church and state in states where there had been an established church. You see, that was the key. The separation of church and state did not mean the separation of God from the state. Those were not the same. It was simply to say that there could be no established church which governed the state, or no state which governed the church. That was the difference. But it didn't mean you kept God out of the state. These men could have never thought of it. What do you mean? The highest moral being, the highest reason for any means of morality and good and right and wrong, we don't take him from the state. Even Franklin knew that. For this will only last if it's governed by a holy moral people. They knew you couldn't rob God from the system, or you'll lose everything. And we are seeing the effects of seeds which have been sown for the past century and a half of removing God from the foundation. That was unthinkable at that time. I love what Isaac Backus said about the separation of church and state. He said, the state should have no place in dealing with church matters, not because they are too low or too out of the place, but because they are too high and holy, and therefore they render the state inadequate in dealing with it. In other words, the reason the state stays out of church matters is because the things that happen in the church are way too important and beyond anything the state can ever take care of. It's just too big, it's too high, and it's too holy for the state to ever deal with. This establishment took place in Maryland and New York during the Revolution, but not until 1786 through the efforts of Jefferson and James Madison, with the help of ministers like John Leland, did the Anglican Church finally lose its privileged position in Virginia, as well as in New Hampshire in 1817, Connecticut in 1818, and Massachusetts in 1833. The Congregationalist Church as well separated from the state. The laity began to assume much more prominence in the government and support of the churches. The churches also began to provide chaplains for the army. The churches, following the analogy of the nation which had created a national government by 1789, made constitutions and set up national organizations. In 1784, the Methodists, led by Coke and Francis Asbury, created a national church which became known as the Methodist Episcopal Church. The Anglicans set up what is now known as the Protestant Episcopal Church in 1789. The Presbyterians created a national church in 1788. They had their first General Assembly in 1789. The Dutch Reformed Church created a national church in 1792, and the German Reformed Church in 1793. It was not long, however, that these new churches were shaken up again the second time by a second awakening. One that would not see so much revival as the product of God, but led by men like Charles Finney, which saw revival as something that man could bring about. This all began about the time the new nation was adopting its constitution. The American churches had been moved by the revivals. The Great Awakening had come and awakened a sleeping giant, drove it together in unity. And now the churches, being awakened and tried by the fires of war, were now ready to take up their mission to a new and united nation. A nation that would begin growing very rapidly westward with a new idea of a divine calling, and that is manifest destiny. I'm going to stop there tonight. Next time we are together, we'll begin focusing in on the 19th century, looking at the rise of modernism and the way in which the church would respond both positively and negatively with higher evangelicalism and liberal Protestantism. So we'll look at those two things next time. Let's pray. Father God, we just thank you so much for this time. We thank you for this instruction. God, we just ask that you would be with everyone. Keep them safe throughout the week. May they have a blessed week. Keep them safe as they travel home. God, be with all the families who are hurting and suffering in this world. God, there are so many. There are so many areas of need. We just pray that you are going to do a mighty work. We pray that you will use this time of darkness and that you will embolden your church to be the light that you've called us to be, that many might be saved through this time of darkness. God, we thank you for your grace. We thank you for your mercy. And as we were reminded this morning in our sermon, we praise you that wherever we go and wherever you call us, there you will always be. We thank you and we praise you. We say these things in your holy name. Amen.